This is February 15th, 2009, and today I'm going to read from and comment on a book called The Geography of Thought, How Asians and Westerners Think Differently and Why. The reason I wanted to devote a Taisho to this is not just because of how fascinating it is to come to understand how different perspectives Westerners and Asians have, but because of the implications of this tradition. There was one of our annual Zen teachers meetings where after going through a number of topics over the 3 or 4 days of meeting, we all agreed that what it all comes down to is how to adapt Zen or Buddhism, how to adapt Zen to a Western culture, how to adapt a tradition that grew out of the soil of Asia, Confucian with a Confucian ethos, how to adapt that to a culture, a society that is anything but Confucian, and it's different in so many ways. So it strikes me as it could only be helpful and illuminating to us in our practice to understand some of these basic differences, not to mention just being able to navigate our way now in a world that is becoming smaller and smaller, that is, where we have more intercourse, more dialogue and involvement with not only Asians, but other people. It's a way to really appreciate diversity and work with it. He starts, the author is a Richard Nisbett, N-I-S-B-E-T-T. There's a lot of acclaim for this book in the pages in the beginning and the end from scholars and others. Just a little bit about him. He has taught psychology at Yale University and currently teaches at the University of Michigan, and mentioned some of his many awards, including a Guggenheim Fellowship and others. He begins in his introduction by challenging the notion that human cognition is everywhere the same. He says that that members of different cultures differ in their metaphysics or fundamental beliefs about the nature of the world. And then about half of the book is a presentation of studies, research of all kinds that confirms that there are very real and basic differences in the ways that Westerners see the world, especially Americans, but Westerners as compared to Asians. He takes as a sort of a framework that Greece and China. He begins by saying more than 1 billion people in the world today claim intellectual inheritance from ancient Greece. More than 2 billion are the heirs of ancient Chinese traditions of thought. And he traces back what different causes there were between Greece and China, and as a way of understanding how these very different cultures evolved. I'm not going to dwell much on this, but just a little bit to appreciate the differences. The Greeks, he said, had a remarkable sense of personal agency, the sense that they were in charge of their own lives and free to act as they chose. And then along with this sense of personal agency came a strong sense of individual identity. In China, the preeminent value was harmony. The Chinese were concerned less with issues of control of others or the environment than with self-control, so as to minimize friction with others in the family and village, and to make it easier to obey the requirements of the state administered by magistrates. The Chinese had a sense of collective agency, not personal agency. And most important to them was carrying out prescribed roles in an organized hierarchical system. That was the essence of Chinese daily life. There was no counterpart to the Greek sense of personal liberty. Within any social group, any form of confrontation, such as debate, was discouraged. He distinguishes between harmony and conformity. It is not the same. The Greek language itself encouraged a focus on attributes and on turning attributes into abstractions. There was in Greece the appreciation of knowledge for its own sake, and the freedom to pursue knowledge, and the curiosity that grew out of that. Whereas for the Chinese, there was no thought of any sense of knowledge without the consequence for action. So they didn't much have any use for knowledge for its own sake. The Chinese pursuit of knowledge was based on practicality. So there are a lot of inventions that are attributed to the Chinese, but these are based on practicality. And as far as the sciences, the larger sciences, this is something that the West has distinguished itself far more in, because of this, he argues, this sense of curiosity or knowledge for its own sake, pure research. There is this, in Greece and in the West generally, there is this orientation toward abstractions, which again is different from the Chinese sense of the concrete. And with abstractions comes a sense of things. The world is full of things that are more or less static, whereas in China the world is constantly changing and is full of contradictions. He makes the point that Confucianism, like Taoism, is less concerned with finding the truth, whatever that's supposed to mean, than with finding the Tao, the way to live in the world. Confucianism stresses economic well-being and education. By the way, both Confucius and Socrates were contemporaries of the Buddha, more or less. It's a fantastic thing to realize that some of these great people lived in what has been called the Axial Age, along with the Buddha. Also, Lao Tzu, or Xuang Tzu. I always mix them up. And then this, the big divide that I think is emphasized more than anything else in this book is the difference between Western sense of independence and the Asian sense of interdependence. And with interdependence comes appreciation for context and field. We'll get to that a little more later. For the reading here from the book, for the Chinese, the background scheme for the nature of the world was that it was a mass of substances rather than a collection of discrete objects. Looking at a piece of wood, the Chinese philosopher saw a seamless whole composed of a single substance, or perhaps of interpenetrating substances of several kinds. The Greek philosopher would have seen an object composed of particles. And this is reflected in all kinds of ways. Chinese social life was interdependent, and it was not liberty, but harmony that was the watchword. The world was complicated, events were interrelated, and objects and people were connected not as pieces of pie, but as ropes in a net. You can see, you know, most of this book, people who've been practicing Zen for any period of time will appreciate, will understand intuitively. But what I like so much about this book is that the author articulates it so well. And even for me, here I've been practicing this for decades, and for me it became much clearer what this tradition is and the context in which from which it arose. And then also he presents a lot of studies in the book that confirm what otherwise would just be his hypotheses, working with both Asian students at the University of Michigan and other schools, Asian students and Western students, lots of studies that show these differences, that prove these differences over and over. The Greeks define nature as the universe minus human beings and their culture. Whereas for the Chinese didn't separate, they didn't divide nature in this way. They didn't posit nature is as this abstraction outside us. There's us and there's nature out there. He goes into why there would be these differences between what originated in Greece and what originated in China. It's kind of interesting, but we don't have time to go into it much. But just very, very briefly, the political system in Greece was unique in that it was consisted of the city-state and its politics, especially the assembly, and so. There was an independence among the different city-states, and one could go from one to the other and be welcomed and would then go on pursuing debate. There was also in Greece a substantial mercantile class who could afford to have their sons educated, education in knowledge for its own sake, again, rather than in China, where education was not a where in China education was a route to power and wealth. I recently heard on an NPR Chinese American who was very critical of Confucianism as just a kind of a, basically what it all comes down to, she was saying, was a way to be successful and rich. Whereas for the Greeks, the drive toward education, he says, was the result of curiosity and a belief in the value of knowledge for its own sake. He also sees this as to be explained as the fact that the Greeks were at a crossroads of the world. They were constantly encountering novel and perplexing people, customs, and beliefs. This would cause them to have to deal with contradictions, and that would give rise to debate, the whole tradition of debate, which was is largely absent in China, he says. China was isolated. China had they were not any crossroads of maritime traffic or anything else, so they didn't have to deal with diversity. He also traces the Chinese value of interdependence and sensitivity to relationships as coming out of the agriculture, the ecology of China consisted and consists primarily of relatively fertile plains, low mountains, and navigable rivers, and this favored agriculture. Agricultural peoples need to get along with another, with one another, to live together in a reasonably harmonious fashion. This is particularly true for rice farming, which requires people to cultivate the land in concert with one another. But it's also important wherever irrigation is required. The ecology of Greece, on the other hand, which consists mostly of mountains descending to the sea, it favored hunting, herding, fishing, and trade. These occupations require relatively little cooperation with others. So for the Chinese, their relations with others provided both the chief constraint in their lives and the primary source of opportunities. The habit of looking toward the social world could have carried over to a tendency to look to the field in general, and the need to attend to social relations could have extended to an inclination to attend to relations of all kinds. So for the Chinese, there was the sense that the self was linked in a network of relationships and social obligations, and so they naturally view the world in general as continuous and composed of substances rather than discrete and consisting of distinct objects. The Greeks, on the other hand, focused on the attributes of objects with a view toward categorizing them and finding the rules that would allow prediction and control of their behavior. Causality would be seen as due to properties of the object, or as the result of one's own actions in relation to the object. But for the Chinese, it was very different. It was the field. So agricultural people are more field dependent. And so patterns of attention and perception meant that, with regard to patterns of attention and perception, Easterners attend more to environments and Westerners attend more to objects. And Easterners are more likely to detect relationships among events than Westerners. Easterners tend to believe less in the controllability of the environment than Westerners. Where Westerners see stability, Easterners see change. In terms of habits of organizing the world, Westerners prefer categories, and Easterners are more likely to emphasize relationships. In terms of dialecticism, let's just get a definition there. In place of logic, the Chinese developed a type of dialecticism. It's sort of the opposite of logical thought. It seeks not to decontextualize, but to see things in their appropriate contexts. Events do not occur in isolation from other events, but are always embedded in a meaningful whole in which the elements are constantly changing and rearranging themselves. To think about an object or event in isolation and apply abstract rules to it is to invite extreme and mistaken conclusions. It is the middle way that is the goal of reasoning. So you can see how much of this is reflected in the Dharma, in Zen teaching. Now, the differences between the Western and the non-Western sense of self. This is really getting into the nitty-gritty of this. In Asia, maintaining harmonious social relations is likely to take precedence over achieving personal success. Success is often sought as a group goal rather than as a personal badge of merit. Individual distinctiveness is not particularly desirable in Asia. Think of the stories we've read about in Japanese corporations where they begin the day doing either calisthenics together or doing a cheer for the company. Such a strong sense of group identity. Whereas in the West, it is so much more the emphasis on the individual self. He says, an Asian friend told me the most remarkable thing about visiting American households is that everyone is always thanking everyone else. Thank you for setting the table. Thank you for getting the car washed. In her country, everyone has clear obligations in a given context, and you don't thank people for carrying out their obligations. Choice is not a high priority for most of the world's people. Well, we've often talked here, commented on how choice has risen to an absolute ultimate value in the United States. And he talks somewhat about this emphasis on relationships among Asians over sense of personal agency, of controlling things. He compares our primer, Dick and Jane, See Dick run, see Dick play, see Dick run and play. In other words, us doing things, having effects on the world. But the first page of the Chinese primer of the same era shows a little boy sitting on the shoulders of a bigger boy. Big brother takes care of little brother. Big brother loves little brother. Little brother loves big brother. And then he says, it is not individual action, but relationships between people that seem important to convey in a child's first encounter with the printed word. Indeed, he says, the Western-style self is virtually a figment of the imagination to the East Asian. The notion that there can be attributes or actions that are not conditioned on social circumstances is foreign to the Asian mentality. To the Westerner, it makes sense to speak of a person as having attributes that are independent of circumstances or particular personal relations. This self, this bounded, impermeable, free agent, can move from group to group and setting to setting without significant alteration. But for the Easterner, and for many other peoples to one degree or another, the person is connected, fluid, and conditional. And here, I have to comment that this is, in fact, the truth. This is the way things are. There is no little man in here. There is no entity. There is no fixed, substantial, permanent entity that we can call a self. The self, such as it is, the self is relational. This is the nature of things. So we have to try to walk the middle way here, and appreciate that. These aren't just quaint differences among cultures where we have one view and they have the other view with regard to the self and its place in the world, but that experience proves that they're a lot closer to the truth than we are as far as that sense of a separate ego identity. The tricky thing here is to recognize that we have our own conditioning, and nothing is going to change that conditioning anytime quickly, and that we have to work with our conditioning. We have to work with this sense of a self, and its place in the world. And that's what is the central challenge in adapting Zen to the West, and certainly teaching it, is to appreciate the inherent grain, the American grain, or the Western grain, and like a woodworker or a sculptor, to work with the grain and not try to suppress what is very deep conditioning for us. Here's an interesting contrast. Easterners feel embedded in their in-groups, like family, or one's the company one's works for, or even one's nation. Easterners feel embedded in their in-groups and distant from their out-groups, other families, other companies, or other nations. Westerners feel relatively detached from their in-groups, like family and company, and tend not to make as great distinctions between in-group and out-group. And there are things to be said for that. There are positive things to be said for that. We don't certainly want to think for a minute that the differences, the Asian mentality, means that they are somehow superior as human beings. For example, we know that there is great ill will toward the Japanese for everything they did in World War II, and we can cite horrendous things, the rape of Nanking and other things that show that not everyone in Asia is a saint. Or in the West, it's not a matter of one's inherent virtue. I think this book comes down to what is it about the Asian tradition of Zen or Asian social tradition that we can work toward that will enable us to live more harmoniously, just for starters. In the United States, there's something like 40,000 murders a year, roughly speaking. In Japan, one recent year I read, they had 44 murders a year in Japan. Now, that's something we can work on. So it doesn't mean that there is some absolute good to the Asian worldview, and that it's always better than the Western, but in some ways it certainly works better than our own cultural conditioning. So Roshi Kaplow used to say, who lived in Japan for 13 years, he used to say that one of the most common phrases you hear in Japan is, "We Japanese." So there's this strong sense of national identity in the West, and certainly in the United States. It's the individual identity, the individual ego, the I, the me, and the my, more than the we and the our and the ours. But either way, you're dividing the world. In one way, the sense of identity is a bit larger, the Asian way. In the West, it's smaller. It's the individual, more the individual. But what Zen offers is a way to get beyond divisions. Not rejecting one's family identity, one's cultural identity, even one's national identity, not rejecting that, but seeing beyond it. In Chinese, he says, there is no word for individualism. The closest one can come is the word for selfishness. The Japanese often call themselves jibun, which leads to a term meaning my portion. The Eastern conviction that one is a different person when interacting with different people. Tell me about yourself seems a straightforward enough question to ask of someone, but the kind of answer you get very much depends on what society you ask it in. North Americans will tell you about their personal traits. I'm friendly, I'm hardworking, or their role categories. I'm a teacher, I work for a company that makes microchips, or activities. I go camping a lot. In other words, I. The Chinese, Japanese, and Korean self, on the other hand, very much depends on context. I am serious at work. I am fun-loving with my friends. Twice as many Japanese as American self-descriptions refer to other people, such as I cook dinner with my sister. Americans, he says, report themselves to be more unique than they really are, whereas Asians are much less likely to make this error. So there's this word I've raged about in the past, special. Oh, she's a special person. How precious. Asians rate themselves much lower on most dimensions, not only endorsing fewer positive statements, but being more likely to insist that they have negative qualities. Americans are much more likely to make spontaneous, favorable comments about themselves than our Japanese. Oh, you gotta laugh, or you cry. It isn't that Asians feel badly about their own attributes. Rather, there is no strong cultural obligation to feel that they are special or unusually talented. He says the stance of perfectionism through self-criticism continues throughout life. Sushi chefs and math teachers are not regarded as coming into their own until they've been at their jobs for a decade. And this is the tradition in Zen too, but it's eroding fast. Now there are, I hear about American Zen teachers who have just 6 years of practice experience, and that we can be sure will continue to erode. This big difference he cites between the Western push to feel good about the self and the Asian drive for self-improvement. He says somewhere in the book that he found himself involved in some kind of parent-teacher conference where there was a serious debate about whether the primary aim of education is to learn or to build self-esteem. And then he also looks back to the formative influences on these differences. Training for independence or interdependence starts quite literally in the crib. Whereas it is common for American babies to sleep in a bed separate from their parents or even in a separate room, this is rare for East Asian babies, and for that matter, babies pretty much everywhere else in the world. Back to the thing about choice. He cites a study where they were given a task to children solving anagrams. The American children showed the highest level of motivation when they were allowed to choose the category. The Asian children showed the highest level of motivation when mom chose the category. Isn't that interesting? When American mothers play with their toddlers, they tend to ask questions about objects and supply information about them. But when Japanese mothers play with their toddlers, their questions are more likely to concern feelings. They're more likely to use feeling-related words when their children misbehave, such as, "The farmer feels bad if you did not eat everything your mom cooked for you." "The toy is crying because you threw it." "The wall says, ouch." You know, when I read this last week, I recalled when a good old friend of Roshi Kaplow's from Japan, Sogen Roshi, he came and visited us in, I don't know, the mid-70s or so, and he went around and gave little instruction to the instrument players, and at that time, I was the first string Mokugyo player. And so we did a chanting service with him watching, and I was playing the Mokugyo, and I was playing it too hard for his taste. And his response was, he leaned over. He was right next to me there in the Mokugyo. He leaned over and he gently tapped the Mokugyo, and he says, "Poor Mokugyo, poor Mokugyo." And then he presents a lot of evidence that Asians are more accurately aware of the feelings and attitudes of others than are Westerners. Westerners teach their children a transmitter orientation. That is, the speaker is responsible for uttering sentences that can be clearly understood by the hearer. Asians, in contrast, teach their children a receiver orientation, meaning that it is the hearer's responsibility to understand what is being said. And this reminded me that Japanese, the teishos by Japanese teachers are not nearly as explicit, or not nearly as, there's a lot more vague utterances and things that most Westerners would find hard to understand. Here's some other distinctions between the independent and the interdependent societies. Insistence on freedom of individual action versus a preference for collective action. A desire for individual distinctiveness versus a preference for blending harmoniously with the group. A preference for egalitarianism and achieved status versus acceptance of hierarchy and ascribed status. And then this is a very interesting one. A belief that the rules governing proper behavior should be universal, that's the Western, versus a preference for particularistic approaches that take into account the context and the nature of the relationships involved. Westerners, and this last point about morality, Westerners prefer to live by abstract principles and like to believe these principles are applicable to everyone. To set aside universal rules in order to accommodate particular cases seems immoral to the Westerner. To insist on the same rules for every case can seem at best obtuse and rigid, and at worst cruel. Now, I single out this in particular because of the long-standing tension in American Zen regarding the misconduct of Asian teachers, and how difficult it is for Asian teachers to understand this thing about basic principles that everyone has to follow. And that's just one of these things that I think it's going to be a long time before we can bridge that gap. This is where I feel very much a Westerner, that certainly with spiritual teachers, with Zen teachers, you can't have some other moral code where you can wantonly have your way with your students or carry on, you know, in drunkenness year after year. But for the Japanese, it's not that they say this is a good thing to do. It's just that they reserve judgment. They don't make an issue out of it. Okay, that's what he or she is doing, and I don't do that, they might say, but there it is, and it's not for us to judge them because they're teachers. Don't buy it. I've said from this seat in Teisho before that okay, there are cultural differences that the Japanese, and especially maybe the Chinese too, Koreans, but the Japanese are much less moralistic than we as Westerners, much less likely to find something wrong or improper. Then they can do what they want in Japan. But here, it's the context. You know, this is kind of an Asian perspective. Here, when you're here, you have to consider the context and our own perspective on what's right and what's wrong, and respect that while you're here. He introduces The idea, this a saying, someone said, the idea moves west, meaning that the values of individuality, freedom, rationality, and universalism became progressively more dominant and articulated as civilization moved westward from its origins in the Fertile Crescent. The Babylonians codified and universalized the law. The Israelites emphasized individual distinctiveness. The Greeks valued individuality even more and added a commitment to personal freedom, the spirit of debate and formal logic, and so forth and so forth. And the United States is the westernmost on that scale. This is another part of the fascinating part of the research he presents is how our perspectives, whether West or East, are malleable. That we're not, and this sort of confirms the Asian view of the conditionality of the self, that people who live in the other culture, that is Asians who live in the West or Westerners who live in Asia, show through testing that they adopt and adapt to the culture in which they're living for a while. And this is what intrigues me especially, is for those of us especially who've been practicing Zen for a long time, to what degree we have absorbed these, you can call them Asian perspectives. Another way to look at it is just seeing things in a new way as a result of having let go of our Western conditioning. That's, I think, is really what it comes down to. And I suppose you would expect to see the same in Asia. If a Westerner went... Yeah, that's hard to say. Here's something. Debate is almost as uncommon in modern Asia as in ancient China. There is not much argumentation or trafficking in opinions in Asian life. A Japanese friend has told me that the concept of a lively discussion does not exist in Japan because of the risk to group harmony. Koreans have no faith that correct ideas will win in the marketplace of ideas. This made me think of this quite amazing story I heard from Roshi Kaplow, that Harada Roshi, his first main teacher in Japan, Harada Roshi forbade his students to even read the books of another Zen teacher. It's hard to imagine that. But now, if you see in this light, then it's more understandable. The combative rhetorical form is also absent from Asian law. And then he talks about the Japanese idea of having eyes in the back of your head, which he interprets as meaning being aware of people around you. He talks about one of his Japanese students who went to a football game at the University of Michigan, was thrilled by the game, but he was appalled by the behavior of his fellow students. They kept standing up and blocking his view. In Japan, he told me, everyone learns from an early age to watch your back. Make sure that what you do doesn't impinge on the pleasure or convenience of others. This is another huge difference. Asians view the world, he says, through a wide-angle lens, whereas Westerners have tunnel vision. And then he shows experiments here where in a picture of an aquarium, the Westerners will tend to focus on the focal fish or the focal image, and Asians much more on the background and the context, the rocks or the seaweed or things around it. He says, as we anticipated, the Japanese participants noticed many more background differences and more relationship differences than Americans did. The Americans are more likely to pick up changes in focal foreground objects. Americans are more capable of separating an object from its context. Here's an interesting, very timely one, where in showing a trajectory or a trend, say on a graph, where you show, say, the stock market going up and up, experiments showed that Westerners are more likely to assume that it will keep going up, whereas Asians, with their appreciation of change and contradiction, they are actually more likely, when they see an upward line on a graph, they're more likely to predict that it'll go down. Could have used that a few months ago. Western utopias focus more on a steady linear progress. And once attained, the utopia becomes a permanent state. Whereas Asians don't see it that way. Nothing's permanent. That's Buddhism too. And also Asians, in terms of crime, Asians are much more likely to explain criminal behavior as reflecting the influence of the environment and other people around you, whereas Westerners more commonly see it as kind of the bad seed notion, that there's something fundamentally wrong or bad about a person. And that too is something we reject through the Buddhist experience. There is no permanent thing in anyone, although of course, if you have someone who does atrocious things, then you can't continue giving them other more chances to wreak havoc on the world. You have to lock them up. Much bigger emphasis in Western education and in testing of Westerners on nouns. And in Asians on verbs. And seeing, among Asians, seeing complex causal connections rather than a simple, direct, linear cause, such as can be, you can blame someone, one person. So this is where for example, in the case of George Bush, there are people who just mindlessly blame George Bush and Dick Cheney for everything without the awareness that we elected them and that it's not so simple that it's just them. Oh, that's very nice. Blame it all on one or two people. But a more enlightened perspective is to see that it came out of the context. It came out of the tremendous fear, that a backlash of fear after 9/11, and that created the context, the soil, to give rise to this these guys. All right, we're just some final words. We've run out of time. I jotted down a few things that where we could some so-called Asian views or Asian ways of seeing the world that can we need to preserve in Zen. Certainly in Zen training, I'm not ready to open the floodgates and have choices of infinite number of choices available to people here on staff. I think it's something that can also be applied in at home, that choices tend to reinforce the illusion of a separate self and the idea that we can have things our way, we can control the environment. I think there's so many ways in Zen practice, not just in training at the center, but in practice at home, where we can work on reducing our tendency to assert the self. We can do this somewhat in language. Over time, we can come to find ways of expressing things that aren't so dependent on the personal pronoun, especially the I, the me, and the my. We can rein in our tendency to express our opinions at the drop of a hat. We can rein in our tendency to argue and to give way to partisan politics. And we can work on getting beyond the notorious American self-absorption, where on a large scale we're ignorant of the rest of the world. Maybe this day show is a step in that direction. But also on a much smaller scale, our awareness of the needs of those around us. On staff recently, we've been working more on developing this at formal meals. When we have formal meals, there's a tendency, I think it's fair to say, for people here to just take care of themselves and not worry about the person to their left or to their right or across the table. And this just further reinforces a sense of separate self. Instead, we can work on these things. None of these things, we're not stuck with any selfish attribute. We can work with these things. That's what training means. And so to make a point of widening one's tunnel vision at the table and being aware out of the corner of one's eye, just peripherally, what other people might need, the items on the table that they might need passed to them. This is a step in that direction. Less self-absorption. Not oversimplifying causal connections. I just mentioned that. There's so many ways that we tend to do that and just blame one person or one group. One thing I didn't mention was that he presents evidence, convincing evidence, that there's less among Asians, there's less curiosity and less of a sense of wonder. This is not something we want to give up. And anyway, it's not a matter of forcing ourselves to be different than what we are. It's the from a Zen perspective, it's just doing the sitting, day in and day out. Staying with it, and then what isn't inherent to our nature will eventually slide off us. We become more. We do broaden our awareness of other people through long Zen practice. We do become more attuned to the feelings of others. We become less self-absorbed, less self-centered. But along the way, before we get there, we can also consciously, deliberately do things that will accelerate this process of opening up to others. All right, time is more than up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.